The day before Governor Rauner's budget address in Springfield, we discuss what kind of message we might expect and what the state could look like if the budget stalemate continues.
We're talking about deficits of $13.5 billion, $14 billion a year, and it's going to be growing if we don't change anything.
We'll talk with David Merriman from the University of Illinois Institute for Government and Public Affairs and learn about a budget proposal put forth by the nonpartisan government research organization, the Civic Federation. Plus, hundreds of conservative evangelical leaders have signed a letter publicly denouncing President Trump's immigration executive order.
We have pastors from every one of the 50 states, including some of the biggest pastors in the country, basically urging the president and the vice president to reconsider.
That's Matthew Sorens of World Relief speaking on Morning Edition. We'll talk with Christianity Today magazine about how the issue has divided evangelical Christians. And we learn about new initiatives aimed at providing food to those in need. That's all coming up on this hour of the 21st. Stay tuned. Welcome to the 21st. I'm Brian Moline, sitting in for Nyla Boodoo today. Illinois is still without a state budget. For those of you counting, it's now been 19 months. That's the longest any U.S. state has operated without a budget. Governor Bruce Rauner will give his annual budget address tomorrow from the state capitol. David Merriman joins us on the phone now to help preview what to expect during tomorrow's address. He's the co-director of the Fiscal Futures Project at the University of Illinois Institute of Government and Public Affairs. David, thanks for joining us today on the 21st.
Hi, thanks. Nice to be here.
Let's just kind of get a status update, if you will. How bad have things gotten fiscally in the state of Illinois?
I don't know if I have an adjective to describe it. Really terrible. I mean, we're really basically a completely dysfunctional state in terms of the fiscal position of the state. We're not raising nearly enough revenue to pay for the spending that we're doing. And we really, much of the spending that we're doing has only kind of a weak legal rationale for it. And, you know, the revenues are just insufficient.
What are you expecting Governor Bruce Rauner to say during his annual budget address? And what do you want to hear?
Well, I guess I think it's important to put in context what you would normally expect at a budget address. You would expect that there would be a very large document, which would be the proposed state budget, which would run several hundred pages, and would detail, you know, categories of spending and the revenues to support them, and which by the Constitution has to show that there are sufficient revenues to support the proposed spending in that document. And that's what occurred in most years, or something close to that occurred in most years prior to the last couple. I think we won't see that. We probably will see a budget book. But the governor has acknowledged in public very recently that there aren't sufficient revenues to support the spending that's essentially required, either by continuing appropriations or by law or just by basic kind of humanity. And I think the governor is going to have to somehow finesse the constitutional responsibility that he has to present a balanced budget the way he did that in the last time he presented the budget. Is essentially with an asterisk saying we have $3 billion that we're going to have to work out later, either by spending cuts or by additional revenues. So I think he's going to have to do something like that. And, you know, I don't think that there'll be much information in the budget book that's put forward. I think we know the governor will encourage the legislature to work with him towards a balanced budget. But he won't say explicitly what new revenues he's going to add or he's willing to accept, nor will he say what expenditures he's going to cut.
The backdrop of this is that leaders in the Illinois Senate have been working on a so-called grand bargain budget package over there. That plan looks to be a bit of a moving target right now, but from what you know about it, how does it compare to what you and your colleague Richard Dye proposed in your most recent fiscal futures report in November?
Well, I should say what Dick and I wrote was what we thought it would take to close the budget gap over a period of time. I don't mean to say it's a proposal or that we're advocating it. This is an example. There's lots of different ways that it could be done. The fundamental thing that we think is that we need a great deal of new revenue. We think we probably need on the order of $10 billion a year of new revenue. I just saw another group has put put out a report saying they think we need to start with around $4 billion and that it needs to grow over time. So there's a widespread agreement that we need a, you know, very, very substantial amount of new revenue, more than the amount of new revenue that could be raised even by sort of modest increases in the income tax rate, the personal and corporate income tax rates. The Senate, as you say, the Senate discussions are a moving target. It looks like they're talking about raising the personal and corporate income tax rates back to somewhere around the rate they were in 2015 before the decline. So that would be about 5% for the personal income tax rate, about 7.5% for the corporate income tax rate. And it also looks like they're thinking about some other revenue, other items that might cause revenue to grow a small amount more. But frankly, those other items, and these would be, there was at one point a talk about a sort of a replacement for the corporate franchise tax. There's modest increases in the sales tax base to cover some services. Those things have been on and off the table. It doesn't look like any of those are nearly enough revenue. So the plan, even the most optimistic reading of the Senate plan, probably wouldn't have sufficient revenue to balance the budget, maybe ever, but certainly not in the short term.
Now, you mentioned that most agree that the state does need more revenue. I guess the counterpoint to that was the conservative Illinois Policy Institute's recent proposal that they say they could balance the state budget without any tax increases. I'm curious if you've seen their proposal, and if so, what are your thoughts on that?
I haven't looked at it in detail. I have looked at, you know, what kind of spending cuts it would take. We're certainly talking double-digit spending cuts, 20% or more cuts in spending. I think even if it's logically possible to do that, and it may not be, or legally possible to do that for reasons I can explain, there's no political will to do that, right? Even the governor, who's a conservative Republican, wants to increase spending for K-12 education. Well, that's a big chunk. That's the second biggest item in the state budget. And, you know, so if you take that off the table, there aren't a lot of other places to cut. Medicaid spending, there are various legal restrictions on what you could cut, and that's the biggest item in the budget. Pension spending is probably the third biggest item in the budget, and you can't cut that. We've gone through various court cases that show you can't cut it. So I just don't think it's not even remotely possible to think that we could get anywhere near a balanced budget with cuts that would, you know, allow us to function as a state at all. So we're clearly not going to be able to do it just with spending cuts.
You know, it certainly seemed unthinkable at some point that we could go through a governor's entire term without an actual budget. But we're already halfway through Governor Rauner's first term without one. What would the state's fiscal situation look like by the fall of 2018 if we continue to limp along as we have been?
It's almost impossible to imagine it. We're talking about deficits of more than $10 billion a year, maybe as high as, so if you're asking me about 2018, I'm just going to look up the number. But we're talking by 2018, given the current situation, we're talking about $13.5 billion, $14 billion a year, something like that. And it's going to be growing if we don't change anything. It's hard to, and we would also be talking about, you know, a very, very large increase in unpaid bills, which are already over $10 billion. It's hard to believe that vendors would continue to work with the state with that kind of massive unpaid bills. It's hard to believe that we could continue to have access to the credit markets. A couple of credit rating agencies have already issued very stern warnings to the state saying basically, you're fiscally dysfunctional and you're hurting the long-term economy of the state. And they've downgraded us, you know, to the lowest, by far the lowest state in the nation.
One more question for you, David. Certainly Illinois is in an unprecedented situation with its state budget. What's the closest any other state has been to what we're seeing right here?
Well, I don't have the full historical record. The most recent example was Pennsylvania, which went about 6 months, I believe, without a budget. During the first part of the time, Illinois was without a budget. But and there they also had a divided legislature and governor. It was a Democratic governor and a Republican legislature there. They were able to come to an agreement. No one was happy with it. So I think, you know, we might look to other states like that as a model of how to get the political courage to get out of this.
David Merriman is co-director of the Fiscal Futures Project at the Institute of Government and Public Affairs at the University of Illinois. David, thanks so much for joining us today on the 21st.
Thanks a lot. Nice to talk to you.
And we continue our conversation on the budget ahead of Governor Rauner's budget address tomorrow. Last week, the Civic Federation recommended a sizable tax hike for Illinois as part of its budget proposal to save the state from its billions of dollars in debt. The Civic Federation is a nonpartisan government research organization based in Chicago. Lawrence Massal is the president of the group. He's on the line with us now. Lawrence, thanks for joining us today on the 21st.
Thanks for having me.
Certainly, there are many parts of your proposal, Lawrence, but let's start on the revenue side. How big of an income tax hike do you think the state needs at this point to help get its fiscal house in order?
Well, first of all, the state needs, in order to get its fiscal house in order, a budget. The state's been operating for almost 19 months without a comprehensive balanced budget, and that has cost the state of Illinois and the taxpayers a fortune. This not having a budget is not the same as not spending money. And those that purport to think that we can close this budget deficit and reach consensus need to come forward with the massive amounts of cuts. The current deficit for the state of Illinois is about $5 billion in terms of known revenue that we have and the amount of obligations and authorized spending that are going out the door even without a budget.
Of course. Just looking at your proposal in detail, Lawrence, you know, one of the things that you do recommend here is an income tax hike as part of your plan. What kind of a hike do you think would be in order right now?
Well, in order to stabilize the state's finances, we need to both reduce spending and limit the rate of growth of spending. But even then, because the state has so recklessly allowed its financial condition to deteriorate, we have what is expected to be $14 billion in unpaid bills by the end of this year. That requires a tremendous amount of revenue to pay off. The state pays enormous financial penalties, both in the form of prompt payment penalties, sometimes as much as more than 12% a year, and also pays a much higher interest rate for borrowing. So the Civic Federation's proposal is to limit the rate of spending, to stop unnecessarily wasting the taxpayers' dollars with penalty payments and obscene interest rates by having the worst rated credit of any state in the United States, and to provide additional revenue to balance the budget. That would include increasing the state personal income tax up to 5.25% from the current 3.75%, and raising the corporate income tax rate from 5.25% to 7%. We also propose reducing the state's sales tax from 6.25% down to 5.5%, which would be accomplished by following the lead of Governor Rauner and Mayor of Chicago Rahm Emanuel, who both proposed expanding the sales tax base to include some services. We would eliminate or we would exempt business-to-business services. But even that won't be enough to stabilize the state's finances. The Civic Federation continues to support the elimination of Illinois' exemption for retirement income. Illinois is one of the only states with an income tax that provides a full exemption for all retirement income. The federal government provides a exemption only for your Social Security income, depending on what your other revenue is. We believe the state of Illinois can no longer afford to have such a generous exemption, and that we need to have all of the citizens of the state of Illinois participate in the shared sacrifice, and that means we have to end the very generous exemption that none of our surrounding states have for taxing a portion of retirement income.
Lawrence, you also recommend borrowing to pay down the state's backlog of bills. Could you just help us figure out how that would save the state some money?
Well, the most important thing for the state is to stabilize its finances and become predictable as to how the state is going to pay its bills. So as part of a comprehensive plan that includes both reducing unnecessary expenditures, limiting the growth rate of discretionary funding for the state, and raising taxes, the state needs to pay off the approximately $14 billion in unpaid bills. And that can only be accomplished by either very significant additional taxes or by borrowing. And in order to get rid of the backlog and bring the state's unpaid bill cycle up to a more reasonable 30 days or down to a 30 days, we propose that the state borrow $9 billion over 5 years, basically issuing a bond to pay that off. That would, coupled with the other reforms and changes that the Civic Federation recommends, would allow the state to go forward on a very low growth horizon, but one that is much more financially accountable and responsible than the current situation.
Just a minute left here, Lawrence, but I know before you joined the Civic Federation in 2002, you served as a senior advisor to former Governor George Ryan. Of course, Michael Madigan was Speaker of the Illinois House at that time as well. What was the working relationship like between those two men when it came to the budget?
There has always been in Illinois a willingness by the legislature and the governor to engage in give and take. Every other state engages in give and take in terms of developing a budget. Governor Rauner, who has proposed an agenda that includes reforms to make the state's business climate better, is within his rights to basically ask for things as part of an agreement on the budget. But what every other state does, all 49 other states, they all end up with a budget rather than a dispute at the end of the day. Illinois has eliminated much of the pressure on the legislature and the governor by allowing the state employees to be paid, by signing the elementary and secondary education appropriation.
Lawrence, I'm afraid we're going to have to stop right there. Lawrence Massal, president of the Civic Federation, thank you so much for joining us today on the 21st.
Thank you.
Thanks for tuning into the 21st. I'm Brian Moline. Tomorrow on the show, Nyla Boodoo will be back, and the show will be broadcast live from the State House in Springfield in the hour leading up to Governor Rauner's budget address at noon. And today we've been talking about what kind of message we might expect to hear. We're joined now by Dan Lesser. He's coordinator of the Responsible Budget Coalition, which represents about 300 groups around the state, many of them social service agencies that have been directly impacted by the budget impasse. Dan, welcome back to the 21st. Thanks for being with us.
Thanks so much for having me.
Last time we spoke with you on the 21st was last July. It was the day we also spoke with the DeWitt County Resource Center, which had just announced they would have to shut their doors because of the lack of state funding. They're the only licensed addiction treatment center in that central Illinois county, and they were also the only 24-hour crisis community hotline. How common are stories like that one?
They're very common. We've got lots of stories of providers that have had to cut services because of the lack of funding, but as you mentioned, actually close programs or close their doors entirely.
And if you could, tell us a little bit about what the Responsible Budget Coalition does.
Well, the Responsible Budget Coalition is a coalition of over 300 organizations statewide and we're united by our desire to see adequate state revenue to fund needed services, to repair damage that's been done, and to stop making cuts. And so that's our coalition. We have members that represent the full range of the different budget areas. So that's pre-K through 12 education, higher education, human services, public safety, and health care. So we've got representatives from across the spectrum, but our goal is to achieve sufficient revenue to accomplish those purposes. And, you know, in real shorthand, a budget that will enable all families and communities in Illinois to thrive. That's our mission.
Could you share with us maybe some stories you've heard similar to the one that we just shared about the DeWitt County Human Resource Center?
Yes, I can mention a few things. So there's the Center for Prevention of Abuse in Peoria, which served Peoria and six counties. And they had to eliminate their Safe from the Start for Children program and their senior self-neglect program. The Safe from the Start treats trauma in children who are up to 5 years old and have witnessed violence or been exposed to tragedy such as a home fire. The self-neglect addresses senior well-being and supports safety, health, in independent living. So that's one example. Then in the area of autism, the UCP, Heartland Center for Autism in Maryville, closed permanently, and it closed because there was a lack of state funding. The center paid for more than $150,000 of operating costs out of financial reserves, waiting for the budget impasse to be resolved, and with no progress in that, the board of directors closed the center. One other example I'll mention, this concerns homeless youth, the Mahoney Transitional Living Center in Rose Clare, Illinois, which closed just this month, provided shelter to homeless 16 to 24-year-olds and service to help them transition to self-sufficient adulthood. And what we're seeing, I should add, is that we've got a rerun of social service providers not being paid because of a lack of a state budget, just as we saw a year ago. But now these providers have that much less cushion. They've used up their reserves. They've used up their lines of credit with the banks. They've laid off staff. They've cut services. So the lack of a state budget is actually going to have a greater and faster detrimental effect on the provision of these services. And one other thing that I'll say is that I mentioned some provider. This is a statewide issue. It's not any one part of the state. It's across the state. But when you get into parts of the state that are less populated, that provider may be the only provider who's providing those services. So if they go out of business, those services just cease to exist. And so the impact that this has is, you know, a little bit different in different places, but it's a very harsh impact all across the state.
And Dan, what are you hoping to see Governor Rauner address in tomorrow's budget speech?
Well, kind of getting back to where we started, we hope he will propose a fully funded year-long budget that will have enough revenue in it to stop making cuts, to repair the damage that's been done by the impasse, and to make smart investments in people so that all families and communities in Illinois can thrive. That's what we would like to see him propose tomorrow.
And if we do not get a budget here in the near future, we've gone almost 2 years without one now. Could you give us an idea of what the situation might be like for some of the agencies you work with? What would it be like if we get to, say, fall of 2018, still without a budget?
Well, I mean, as I was just saying, I think we're going to see more places cutting services or closing. We know from the United Way survey that was done some time ago that over 1 million people in Illinois have lost services, a wide range of services that they need. And as I said, the impact is being felt statewide. So we've got a higher education system in tatters. We've got a human services sector that's on life support, and it's only going to get worse. You know, every day that we don't have a full year, fully funded budget, it gets worse.
And if you could, kind of explain to us how the state funding works for some of the agencies you work with. I know there's a variety of places that the funding comes from, whether it be contracts with the state or grants. How are some of the, if you could just walk us through kind of how that funding mechanism works.
Yeah, well, a lot of these, I would say by and large, the different service providers that we're talking about have contracts with the state. And so the state has entered into a contract with them to provide services. But because there's a lack of an appropriation for those services, the state isn't paying on their contracts. So it's a lack of appropriation. And then there's the lack of revenue to back up the appropriations. That also is a problem. And that's why we have this tremendous amount of unpaid bills in the $11 billion range. And it's slightly different numbers by different people, but I think that's a pretty good estimate. And so who's not getting paid because of a lack of revenue? Those social service providers. So we're in a situation now. A year ago, social service providers went almost an entire year without getting paid. There was a stopgap budget that was approved on the last day of the fiscal year, June 30th for 2016. But that stopgap budget did not only funded social services for 12 months, and it was intended to cover 18 months. So that includes the last fiscal year and then the last 6 months of 2017 or 2016. So the bottom line is that these providers have not been getting paid on contracts dating all the way back to July 1st of last year. So we're looking at 8 months of non-payment. And again, they have contracts with the state of Illinois, but the state is not living up to its obligation and is not paying them.
Dan Lesser, coordinator of the Responsible Budget Coalition that represents about 300 groups around the state. Thank you so much for joining us today.
Okay. Nice to be with you. Thank you.
Last week, a group of more than 500 conservative evangelical pastors and leaders from across the U.S. signed an open letter denouncing President Donald Trump's temporary ban on refugees. The letter was published in the form of a full-page ad in the Washington Post. Among the signers are several well-known people with ties to Illinois, including Bill and Lynn Hybels of Willow Creek Church in South Barrington, and Ed Stetzer, who's affiliated with both Wheaton College and Trinity Evangelical Divinity School. I'm joined now by a reporter who's been covering this news. Jeremy Weber is a news editor at Christianity Today magazine, which is based in Wheaton. Jeremy, welcome to the 21st, and thanks for joining us.
I appreciate it. Thank you.
It might have been surprising to many people that the signers of this letter included many leaders of the evangelical world who have not previously taken a public position on political issues. But what do you think makes this issue of immigration and refugees different?
I think if you read the letter that was published in the Washington Post, there's the explanation that one of the core commands in Scripture is to love our neighbors as ourselves. So when it comes to the ways that churches try to live out their faith in the public square, caring for refugees and immigrants is one of the primary ones. The National Association of Evangelicals, which is the main umbrella body for evangelicals in the U.S., their humanitarian wing is one of the nine refugee resettlement agencies. And so the fact that refugee resettlement is kind of their primary social cause just speaks to the centrality of the issue.
Yeah, we'll tweet out an article to your recent feature story on this issue, but I want to draw attention to an interesting point that you highlight there. While evangelical leaders overwhelmingly oppose the four-month refugee freeze and reduction in refugee resettlement thereafter, evangelicals in non-leadership positions are more evenly split. What's the latest polling data we have to help us understand what's going on at the grassroots level?
In terms of polling that takes place subsequent to this executive order coming out, we haven't had really great numbers yet. But if we look at basically polling on refugees, over the time of the rise of ISIS, particularly I examined things during the Paris attacks. I was in Iraq reporting on a number of refugee camps and evangelical resettlement efforts from Iraq through Greece to the U.S. when the Paris attacks happened. And so when you look at the numbers before and after, there's distinctly a clear divide between unbalanced majority of pastors and evangelical leaders seeing that, the call to help refugees is important. And while obviously they're cognizant of the importance of security efforts for America, the concerns about security do not override that need to care. But then the polling does show that, like in many areas of society today, there is a bit of a divide between leaders and the grassroots that they represent. And so on balance, a number of Protestant pastors were surveyed, and about half of them said that, their congregation was more likely to be fearful of refugees than to desire to help. And then one of the larger humanitarian groups in the world did a survey kind of specifically related to Syria on how people who self-identified as committed Christians were feeling towards refugees in terms of praying for them, being actively involved. And they've actually seen a decline from 2015 to 2016 in enthusiasm for those efforts.
Do you think part of the reason that evangelical leaders have decided to take a public stance on this issue is that they're hoping they might be able to change the minds of those in their congregations who, as you pointed out, are pretty divided on this issue?
Well, I imagine, they're looking to both influence their congregations, but also, obviously the administration. There's been a number of, comments where like Trump has claimed the mantle of evangelical support or, giving people what they desire. And, like all movements, evangelicals are fairly diverse. And I think it's both I suppose it really illustrates, of the many reasons to vote one way or another in the past election, there are multiple motivations. So I think, if we look back the previous week to reactions to the Supreme Court nominee, you see a primary reason why many evangelicals did choose to support Trump in the general election. Whereas looking at this response to the executive order on refugees and national security, that kind of shows that there is an equal enthusiasm for all aspects of of Trump's the goals for America.
Jeremy, in the letter, the leaders made it clear that they're not asking for favors for Christians from President Trump, who has previously said that he would give priority to Christian refugees. In fact, I'll quote a bit from the letter. It says, "While we are eager to welcome persecuted Christians, we also welcome vulnerable Muslims and people of other faiths or no faith at all." Could you remind us what percentage of refugees that come to the U.S. are religious minorities?
I don't have the exact stat in front of me. So again, like people can go to our website for the specifics. But I believe Pew Research Center found that about a third of refugees are religious minorities, and then the majority of those are Christians. Overall, I think if I believe the time period was either I think over this past fiscal year, there's been a roughly equal admission of Christians and in Muslims. But again, primarily the ratio that gets talked about a lot is the specific ratio from Syria, where, recently, the number of Muslims versus Christians coming has been like 1,000 to 1. And then people want to look at the internal makeup of Syria pre their civil war and say, well, if the number of Christians and Muslims doesn't equal that, there must be a discrimination against Christians in that process. And the problem with that, there's a number of complications with the rate at which we would see persecuted Christians fleeing ISIS or other concerns arriving in the U.S. through our resettlement program. Part of that is just like the length of time it takes. A part of it is there are other avenues for Christians who were middle class and could avail themselves of other means of finding safety. And that's something we've reported on extensively, in part due to the time I spent in Iraq and in Greece.
Jeremy, you also point out in your reporting that under President Trump's plan, fewer people overall would make it to America, and that means fewer persecuted Christians as well. Do you think, if nothing else, that this understanding might shift the balance among evangelicals to oppose these policies?
Well, I mean, we'll definitely have to see. As many people have commented on the challenge of facts in this day and age, persuading hearts and minds on some of these more emotional disagreements in politics. I think that's one of the things that is overlooked. And so I think a close reading of this article or of this letter, it is specifically critiquing both the approach towards the freezing the program for 4 months, but also the kind of corollary, which is that reduction by about half of our goal for intake this year. So even if every single one of the remaining slots in the current fiscal year went to the persecuted Christians leaving the Middle East, we would still be resettling fewer. And I think it's important the Christians that work or the organizations that do focus on religious freedom violations in the Middle East, would love for more people to be able to come to America as a means of safety. But probably the most significant voice is a group called Open Doors, which for about 25 years now has produced the most rigorous and academic assessment of persecution in the Middle East. They do have great concern with the strategy over prioritizing Christians versus Muslims in terms of how it feeds into the narrative over there that the local Christian communities, even though historically they predate Islam by hundreds of years, they do not actually belong in their countries, that they are a product of colonialism of the West. Historically, this isn't a true argument, but that narrative is a very popular one and is something that some of these more radical Islamist groups use to justify their mistreatment. So there is desire to obviously have America be a place of supporting religious freedom and...
Jeremy, I'm afraid we're going to have to end it right there, but Jeremy sure. Weber, news editor at Christianity Today, and we'll tweet out a link to your article, a wonderful article. Thanks so much for being with us today.
Yeah, I appreciate it. Thank you for having me.
You're listening to The 21st. I'm Brian Moline, sitting in for Nyla Boodoo today. Every year, an estimated 70 billion pounds of food go to waste in the U.S., according to a report from Feeding America, the nation's largest domestic hunger relief program. There's a new initiative in the Peoria area, which we'll be launching tomorrow, aimed at reducing food waste using technology. The program helps match restaurants and grocery stores that have food to give away with organizations such as food pantries and shelters that need it. I'm joined now by Denise Uricki, primary manager manager of the Good Food Recovery Program, which is part of the Gifts in the Moment Foundation in East Peoria. Denise, welcome to the 21st, and thanks for joining us today.
Great. Thank you, Brian.
I've heard this program being described as the Uber of fresh food. How exactly does the Good Food Recovery Program work?
Best example to think. Really, what Good Food Recovery is going to focus on are the prepared foods that typically caterers or restaurants or cafeterias have in their kitchen that don't make it out to be served to the public. In the past, that food had to be wasted, and so it ended up in the landfill. Through Good Food Recovery and with a lot of work from our area health departments, we are able to take that prepared food, temp it down, match it with the recipient organization. Typically, the prepared foods would be going to soup kitchens that are serving hot meals. The system makes that match with that recipient organization. It sends an email notification to a food runner. They accept the run, and the food is then transported to the recipient organization. So that food that typically would have been thrown into the garbage, it was perfectly good food, is now going to feed people that are in need.
With this new platform, like you said, the recipients, like food pantries and shelters, can look online to find out what kind of food is available on any given day. How does that food get from point A to point B?
Yeah, that's a great question. It relies on the generosity of folks who volunteer to be food runners. These are folks that our generation now, we're pretty tech savvy. There's an app that can be downloaded onto the phone. Once they sign up to be a food runner, they'll take a short little food safety quiz. We want to make sure that this food is transported in a safe manner. Once they sign up, they'll get an email notification. If they are able to accept that run and make the pickup at the donor and deliver to the recipient, they basically, it's called claiming the run, and that run is then assigned to them.
Peoria is just the third region in the country to launch this program. I understand it started in San Francisco. Since then, it's spread to Seattle and now Peoria. What made you decide to bring this program to the Peoria area?
Yeah, reiterate there what you said about San Francisco, that was the genesis. The software is called ChowMatch. It was developed by a gentleman whose wife was very heavily involved in food pantry and food recovery efforts in the San Francisco, specifically the San Mateo and Santa Clara areas. So this is software that is serving up to 500,000 people. It is live in Montgomery County, Maryland. We are only the third site in the country to go live. Back to your original question as to why we brought it here. We, in our area here in central Illinois, we've had needs identified. All areas of the country struggle with food insecurity and being able to eat healthy. None of us do a really good job of that. And so the Gidim Foundation was looking for a way that we might be able to make the process a little bit better.
That's really what drew us here.
That's okay. Go ahead.
Sure. Obviously, this program is meeting a large need. Can you give us an idea of just how much food goes to waste without a program like this?
Yeah. And actually, we did our due diligence here in our area, and I do want to emphasize that this initial pilot is for the Tri-County area, so it'll be serving Peoria, Tazewell, and Woodford counties initially, and then we will be expanding on from there. For example, in 2010, the EPA estimated that there were nearly 34 million tons of food waste that accounted for 14% of the total municipal solid waste stream. In Peoria County, they actually quantified that amount, and in 2010, 9.3% of the solid waste was comprised of food scraps.
Mm.
So, it's a win-win. This is food that's not going to make it into the landfill. It's perfectly fine. There's nothing wrong with it, and we can get this out to soup kitchens and not-for-profits who are serving hot prepared foods.
Sure. When you're dealing with prepared foods like this, there certainly are some food safety concerns. How does the program go about ensuring food safety?
Right. That is a great question. What we did was we worked very closely with Montgomery County, Maryland. They were the second site to go up on the software platform called ChowMatch, and they recognized the need for food safety policies and procedures to be in place. So we are very blessed to work with Peoria, Tazewell, and Woodford County Health Departments. Their environmental services director sat down with us, reviewed the documentation that we initially had from Montgomery County, Maryland, and all three area departments signed off on it. And so what that means is that there are guidelines for the donor organizations as they prep and once they store the food that needs to be picked up from the food runner. The food runner will read some information, watch a couple videos, and then they're required to take a food safety quiz. And it's really just about basic handling of produce in a safe manner to get it to the recipient organization.
And Denise, how many companies and organizations have signed on so far to take part in this?
Yeah, right now we are, literally in a very, very small pilot. Our official launch is tomorrow. We have two area hospitals on board that are donating that hot prepared food. And right now we have about five recipients that are, I would call them soup kitchens. They're able to serve hot prepared food. But after our launch tomorrow, this will be opening up throughout our Tri-County area.
Sure. And what can someone do in your Tri-County area if they want to get their company signed up or if they want to volunteer as a driver themselves?
Yeah, great question. I would encourage anyone who's interested to visit us at goodfoodrecovery.org. There you can read more about what it means to become a food runner, what is required to be a donor, and to sign up recipient organizations. We're always looking for sponsorship. Our goal is to offer this program at no charge to recipient organizations and to donor organizations. So there is a cost for the software, but our goal is to acquire donations to make sure that this stays free.
Wonderful. Denise Uricki, Primary Manager of the Good Food Recovery Program. It's part of the Gifts in the Moment Foundation in East Peoria. Denise, thanks for being with us today.
Hey, Brian, thanks a lot, and happy Valentine's Day.
You're listening to The 21st. I'm Brian Moline in for Nyla Boodoo today. There may be times we think that we're not in a position to help others, but with a little bit of creativity, we can find a way. So says Ernest Krolik, who runs Smokey's House Barbecue in Savoy. He and his wife have recently launched the Heart Program, which provides an opportunity for their patrons to provide food to others in need. He joins us now to tell us a bit more about it. Ernest, welcome to The 21st, and thanks for being with us.
Hi, thank you.
The seed was planted, so to speak, for this after an incident involving a friend of yours who'd just been laid off from his job, and he came into the restaurant and asked if you could help him out with a free sandwich. Could you just tell us about that story?
Sure. Well, the person who needed the sandwich was a friend of the owner's and a friend of mine, and he had just recently lost his job at the University of Illinois. So He came to us and he asked for help. And being a small business, we always have to think about a lot of different things, especially in Illinois and in Champaign. It's very difficult. And I personally only thought of myself when he asked. I thought about the restaurant. I thought about our financial position. And I felt really terrible. The owner of the restaurant, of course, he was like, we can do these things. We can help people and we can follow our principles and our values, even though our restaurant isn't, a very big, profitable, huge restaurant. It's just a very small business in Savoy. So that's pretty much where the idea came from. My teacher had this idea. The owner of the restaurant had this idea. And it took us a little while to get it going, but finally, we do have the program and the HEART program in place.
Sure, and we'll talk a little bit more about that in detail in just a moment. But you know, you decided you couldn't help that friend at that time, but certainly that experience sounds like it stuck with you. And then later on, you heard another story about a Vietnam veteran in Savoy who was having trouble paying medical bills, didn't have enough money to buy food. How did hearing his story have an impact on you?
I mean, just like all the stories I hear about this type of thing, I just the first thing I think of is why. Like, even when I was a little kid, I couldn't understand why, as a society and as a nation, we have problems that we don't need to have, and I feel like hunger is one of them. I can't wrap my mind around why anybody, especially a veteran, and I hate to say especially, you know, just because I think everybody deserves food and everybody deserves these basic things, especially when there's so much abundance. You know, I feel like, you know, as a nation and, you know, even community-wise, we have enough to go around. So the story of the Vietnam veteran did hit me pretty hard. And you know, that's when the owner and I really started talking. We had these ideas. We really need to do something now because people need help now, not later. But yeah, the story of the Vietnam veteran, but I've actually heard a lot of those. You know, I've heard a lot of stories about veterans and older folks who just aren't getting enough of the basic things that they need. But owning a restaurant and running a restaurant, food is the one thing that, you know, we have more access to help people.
Sure. Just the way the program works, people can come into the store and buy a heart. I know that you and your wife have committed yourselves to donating one heart a week as well. This program getting underway earlier this month, what kind of a response have you seen to it?
We've seen an amazing response. And I think what the response is bringing out is what people can do together. You know, my wife and I are purchasing a heart, but every single employee that works at the restaurant has purchased a heart. And, you know, some of their family members and their friends have purchased hearts. And then our customers are purchasing these hearts. And it's what I think we're seeing is just how things can be expedited and how our goals can be reached a little bit quicker when more people are involved. We had done different benefits over Thanksgiving holiday, over Christmas holiday, and they were really difficult. And I don't feel that they were as successful as I personally wanted them to be. And then I just had this idea that I don't have to reinvent the wheel, that there's a lot of people trying to do a lot of different things. And maybe we could just come together and do these things together.
Sure.
So that's where that came from.
Yeah. And then, you know, how does it work? You know, people buy the hearts and then how do they get redeemed?
Well, we have a couple different ways that we're going about redemption, because there are actually some people who feel a little bit trepidatious about asking for something for free, even though this is a program set up for them. A lot of people, you know, like my friend that came in, it took a lot for him to come to the restaurant and ask for food, because he's not the type of person to ask for these type of things. He's has a lot of pride and you know, he felt a little bit, I'm assuming he just felt a little shy about asking something for free. And I know that there are people like that. So we're going to be working with some churches who are working with veterans. We're working with different groups that are trying to feed the homeless. So people can come to the restaurant and redeem a heart. So basically they just take a heart off the wall. They just speak to any of the employees and we'll give them that food item for free. And all we want is them to just write thank you on the heart. It's not too much to ask just to have a thank you from somebody, to put on the heart so that it's more of a circle of giving.
Absolutely. Ernest, I'm afraid we're going to have to cut it off right there. We're just out of time today, but thank you so much for telling us about this wonderful Pay It Forward program. That's
thank
Ernest Krolik running Smokey's House Barbecue in Savoy. That's all the time we have for today. You can always find past shows on the NPR One app. Just search for the 21st. Follow us on Twitter. Search for 21st Show. We live tweet during the show with more analysis as well. Thanks to the band Public Access for our theme music. We're produced by Hala Dalahi, Christine Herman, and Sean Newman. Abra Alhiti is our intern. Technical direction from Jason Croft with help from Steve Mork. Scott Cameron is our news director. I'm Brian Moldine, and for Nyla Boodoo, Nyla's back tomorrow. Thanks for listening.